We're off.
All right, but now John's
calling. No, I'm here. I'm sorry. I'm trying to bring as much kind of a screwball element to.
Yeah, I was going to say. John, you just disappeared. Hessa's waving a tennis racket around the room trying to kill a fly. Theta seems pretty cool, but I mean, this is really replicating the effect of being in one of these movies. Hessa, stop trying to kill the fly.
Okay.
Okay. Ring, ring, ring. Hello. We've got movies on the line. That's right. It's Movie Mindset. We're back. And if you haven't judged already, we are talking about two classic screwball comedies directed by Howard Hawks and starring Cary Grant. And joining us for this foray, we've got two modern-day screwballs, Theda Hamill and John Early. I would say our generation's equivalent of Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant. Theda, John, welcome to the show.
It's so great to be back. Yeah. Mindset.
Whereas this is my first time.
All right. Welcome.
Welcome.
We'll have to show you the ropes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's a breeze.
So these two movies, we got two classic comedies. And I'd like to say, like, in His Girl Friday, we have a charming screwball romantic comedy about the death penalty.
Yeah.
Yes.
And in Bringing Up Baby, we have a charming screwball romantic comedy about a woman who deserves the death penalty because she is the most dangerous woman ever to be depicted in fiction. I'm talking about Katharine Hepburn and Bringing Up Baby. But I guess we're going to go in reverse chronological order in these movies. And we're going to begin with His Girl Friday from 1940. What I like about this movie is it stars Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell.
From the Columbia Studios in Hollywood comes an exciting new film triumph. A companion hit to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, His Girl Friday, co-starring a thrilling new pair of screen lovers, Devil May Care, Cary Grant, and ravishing Rosalind Russell. Let's listen in to one of their tender, idyllic love scenes.
I am fond of you, you know.
And a girl?
I often wish you weren't such a stinker.
It's a movie about marrying your ex-wife. And what I like about this movie is that it's a romantic comedy about how people... nobody actually changes or wants to change. And nobody learns anything in this movie. And people essentially just end up right back where they started, not going on a honeymoon to Niagara Falls.
Yeah. There are about like four or five plot lines where people are trying to convince other people that they're insane. It happens several times. It happens with the criminal, the mom. And it was the golden era of gaslighting, I think, in this time period.
How this is the golden era of gaslighting.
Oh, that's true. Our current era.
Everything old is new again.
This is the golden era of saying things are gaslighting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
that's totally different.
Google searches are way higher for gaslighting now than they were in the 40s.
So yeah, His Girl Friday is a movie that it exists in the world of newspaper reporting, and the movie begins with a title card that says, "It all happened in the dark ages of a newspaper reporting." And I guess like I was sort of like, I'm trying to like interpret what they could mean by that. And as best I can understand, in the dark ages of newspaper reporting, journalists tried to get people off death row. Whereas now, it's just all about just a factory line. Send them into that gas chamber, boys. Let's keep it well fed. But like obviously the thing His Girl Friday is most famous for, the thing I love about this movie, is that Howard Hawks, essentially like it's a remake of an earlier movie called The Front Page, which was a play, and then basically like in remaking the movie, they just make the main character a woman, and they make it a romantic comedy. They make Rosalind Russell's character like the epitome of the gal journalist, you know, the fast talking, like you know, career girl,
the titular His Girl Friday,
yeah. Absolutely. And the other thing I liked about it is that like Howard Hawks remade this movie because he wanted to beat the original film's record for most words said in a like per minute in a movie. And the crazy thing about this is that this movie was made before multi-track record sound recording was available. So yeah. Basically, they had like 18 different microphones hanging over the heads of every actor in this movie to catch the rapid fire dialogue. That is basically just, this movie is like mostly takes place in one set. And, you know, based on a play, it's mostly people coming in and out of a room and picking up phones and yelling at each other.
Yeah, it's incredible. There's so many like great like bit parts too of people who are like flustered. In both these movies, there's a great thing of people being like, well, I don't know, but hey, wait a minute. And then like, you know, I love that little...
Pettibone.
Pettibone is my favorite character in either of these movies.
Me too. I love him.
The Pettibone, the Pettibone equivalent and of the warden or the whatever he is, and bring up baby. That is an art that has really gone out of the world, and it's like, it's so sublime.
My favorite Pettibone moment is when towards the end, when he comes back in with the reprieve, and he's like, someone says something like, "Go home to your wife," and he's like, My wife is beautiful. And then there's like a pause, and they're like, I'm sure she is. And he pauses, and then he gets really mad, and he's like, if she heard you say something about her looks, she would be pissed. It's like, oh my God. He's so cool.
There are many classic gags and characters and like things that are just always funny. Even a movie made in 1940 is still funny today. And I think like in comedy today, needs to like research some of these classics to understand bits that will always work. Like Submental Oaf. And my favorite comedy bit, the old battle axe. We need more annoying old women in movies. In this case, the fiance's mother, who at one point in this movie, we are meant to believe that Cary Grant has killed her. Has abducted her and gotten into a car crash that has killed the titular, his girl Friday has killed her fiance's mother. So that's just like a little indication of the humor of this movie. And Hester, before we start recording, both of us, like in rewatching this movie, forgot kind of how dark this movie is. Like, it is a comedy about the death penalty.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, the guy on death row is played with such like startling humanity.
He's Earl Williams.
So beautiful, that performance. Yeah. it makes that part extreme. It makes it all much darker because he's like, he's so sad.
Yeah, he's very depressing, and he's clearly like kind of a simpleton too, which makes it, you know, very interesting. And his girl that is in love with him,
Molly Malloy.
I love her.
Yeah, queen. But she doesn't have the best ending.
It's a classic. I think it's an incredibly dark and depleting movie. I feel like it's a very, a good way to talk about like that screwball encompasses like some truly nightmarish demonic energies. Like, it's not just an encounter with vitality that will leave everyone smiling.
Yeah,
and here the innocent couple. I mean, the comedy of remarriage is between a corrupt man and a woman he's managed to re-corrupt.
Yes, a woman he has tricked into falling back in love with him.
Yes, the lovers like that you would have in like a Gilbert and Sullivan context or something. One of them jumps out of a window, and you never hear from her again. Although she doesn't die, and Earl Williams, he's reprieved, who knows what will happen to him? Ralph Bellamy ends up in jail for using forged currency, and his mother has been battered on the street. This is a crazy moral worldview.
No, I'm glad you brought it up. We're now living in the golden era of gaslighting, and in that spirit, I will simply say, screwball is violence. Screwball movies are violence, and that's why they're so funny. And like, okay, the Cary Grant character in this movie, in my notes, I say he's like the not evil version of J.J. Hunsecker from The Sweet Smell of Success. But now that you're talking, I think he's basically just as evil as J.J. Hunsecker.
Yes.
His romantic rival, he gets him arrested for soliciting a prostitute, passing forged currency, and pickpocketing, or he has him pickpocketed.
I forget what puts him in the first time.
He pays a woman to pretend that he groped her.
Blonde.
The albino.
The albino. I love how... All Rosalind Russell has to ask to know that it's like a setup is she blonde? Like, that's the, in the 30s and 40s, that's the only thing blonde, that's the only job they could get.
Woman like, groped on the street.
Yeah, pretending to be groped or convincing, like, Edward G. Robinson to rob a bank for her or something.
And we get the great line, she's no albino, she was born in this country.
That's one of the best lines. That is one of the best lines. There's so much richness in the movie verbally that you can't keep up with it. That's one, I think that contributes to the feeling of depletion. But every second there's something so funny like that, that they just immediately charge on.
Yeah. And going towards like Cary Grant being evil, it's like in one of the most, what you think is one of the most poignant moments in the movie, he has like a Rick at the end of Casablanca moment with Rosalind Russell where he's like, you should go marry him. Like, I want you to be happy. I'm just jealous that he gave you what you never could. I sent a telegram to keep him waiting at the station. And then she's like, wow, thank you. And it's like a very beautiful and moving moment. And then they get a phone call that he's been arrested again because of another thing Cary Grant did. And she's like, I thought you were serious. And he's like, what am I, a fucking moron?
and then she breaks down crying because she thought he meant it.
Yeah.
That's a amazing inversion of the Casablanca moment.
Me and who?
But wait, so, Will, what were you going to say?
Like, the setup of this movie is that Cary Grant is a newspaper editor at the Morning Star, the Morning Post. And for the purposes of this episode, I'm just going to pretend that he's the editor of the New York Post. It's just a slight difference. But yeah, so Cary Grant is the editor of Page Six. And the movie begins with his ex-wife, who is his former star reporter, coming in basically to tell him that she's engaged and moving on and is no longer, and most importantly to him, is no longer going to be involved in the newspaper business. He's no longer going to be an ink-stained wretch, trolling blind gossip items for Cary Grant.
I just, when you said Cary Grant is the editor of the New York, as of Page Six, I pictured like Cary Grant being like, we got an exclusive scoop. Bethany Frankel kicked out of Chaconis for getting too drunk and making a scene.
She was simply eating crab all night by herself. Oh, and putting it on Instagram. Could you believe it?
He does have a lot, one of those throwaway lines where it goes, keep the rooster story. That's human interest.
I totally missed that.
And you know, she's telling me like she's brought her fiance to the office. So it's sort of like letting your new boring husband meet your older, cooler, evil husband, which like that never goes well. You should have, if the fiance character had just waited in the lobby, none of this shit would have happened.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No, he's drawn into the evil orbit of the New York Post and Cary Grant, and you know Rosalind Russell. She says, you're no longer my husband, and you're no longer my boss. And there's a great line where Cary Grant refers to her as a doll faced hick.
She says several times,
you wouldn't have hired me if I wasn't a doll. And he says, why shouldn't you be the only face around I hear I can see without shuddering? Like he's just, everyone he works with is some sort of freak.
It's a novelty that everyone, you know, we need a woman in here who won't make everyone throw up when they look at her.
I also love like when she's like, you can't quit. You love the news too much. And it's like, he's always like Jeff Daniels in the newsroom. He's like, goddamn newsman.
But the news they're talking about is like very different than Jeff Daniels, than like the newsroom where it's like, you know, the most important news in the world. Osama bin Laden has been like killed, that famous newsroom episode. And then like, in this, it's like that mine. It's more small scale, I guess, which is, I guess, because of the time period and because it was newspapers and like it's local. And by local, I mean the newspaper office, the police station, the jail, and
the gallows.
And the gallows, all in the same building, it seems like.
Yeah, but that's just, it's the, in fairness to the implausibility of that, I think it's the courthouse newsroom.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. Oh, yeah, because so, it's the press room, it says on
yeah,
the door.
Yeah, yeah.
And it says Bureau of Streetlights, and there's an arrow going down the stairs in the hallway. So I guess it's like there's all different sorts of public works in this one.
But it is including the gallows.
Including the gallows. Which they are all happy to lie, and they're all lying all the time and very eagerly to get him hang, like the whole yeah. newsroom.
So most of this movie takes place in the press room of the New York City courthouse / Bureau of Streetlights / yeah. / gallows.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like and most of it takes place in this like, you know, smoke-filled press room. And all the other journalists, like Rosalind Russell and then the woman who's interested in the death row convict, they're the only two women in this movie. But yeah. like most of the movie is just these like
which I had a
and
problem
the mother.
With.
And the mother.
Yeah.
But most of this movie is just is yeah, like these men playing cards and sitting around typewriters, and this they're all such hens, all the fucking journalists in this movie. And yeah. there's a great scene where they're like playing cards in the press room, and then they're testing the gallows outside with like the drop on the yeah. fucking noose, and they go, keep it down there, we're trying to work, and they're just like smoking cigars and playing cards, and like yeah. the executioner's like, shut up, I don't tell you how to do your job.
Yeah. And when the criminal escapes and they're like they peek out the window and like alarms are going off, searchlights are everywhere, and they're like, what's going on? And then they get shot at with like a Tommy gun, and they just yeah. duck for 1 second and then go yeah. back in the window, and they're like, say, watch where you're pointing that. It's like it's nothing.
It is worth comparing, just like as a sidebar, to the newsroom, because this is Sorkin's constantly cited favorite movie. And it couldn't be more opposed to his worldview.
Yeah, he doesn't really get it, I feel
Chapo
like.
Has dealt the definitive cultural blow to Newsroom and to Sorkin. And like, but it's the polar opposite, even in terms of word count. Like, everyone in Sorkin's Newsroom is a hero who believes in the purity of news. And this movie, they're all just... like basically sub criminals, like they're all the yeah. And that's where the excitement comes from.
Like even Rosalind Russell, like what she's doing can also be seen as like, because all the other guys in there are like, can we execute him 2 hours earlier, like so we can get the they're all trying to get him executed 2 hours earlier so that they can get
their
in the
deadline.
News before
yeah.
yeah the morning edition goes out. And Rosalind Russell is like, you guys are chumps. You're manipulating this story the wrong way. The actual yeah. way to manipulate it and get the big scoop is to have an exclusive on him, like a humanity type piece. And that's like a theme that is kind of ever present, is like women are the only ones that like, you know, have any shred of humanity. But it's not like Rosalind Russell has a shred of humanity and is using it for good. It's like, oh, she knows how to manipulate people much better than Cary
yeah.
Grant.
Yeah.
And this is like, this is why Cary Grant is like, you know, obviously for his own romantic fixation on his former, his ex-wife, and the name of the movie is Hildy Johnson, and like as his star reporter. And like, you know, the New York Post in this strange alternate universe, like I said, it, you know, movies are not reality. They're trying to get someone off death row rather yeah. than... you know, fill the coffins a little bit faster.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, like a big part of it is that like, he's like, only Hildy can write this because she's got that human touch, which involves yeah. interviewing Earl Williams, the convicted man, in like his giant Hannibal Lecter style bird cage.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Like, and create and like basically coaxing him into saying like he only shot this cop by accident because he had been influenced by communist radicals in the park he was walking in, who talked about
production for use.
And yeah. he thought, oh, well, what's a gun for? It's to be used. And that's why he shoots a cop. Another dark aspect of this movie is that like the racial politics of this death penalty case.
Yeah.
It's a white guy who shoots a black police officer, and yes. the mayor's office in New York City, the sheriff, want to send this guy up the fucking gallows because they need the black vote, which was like
they need yeah. the black vote. Yeah. yeah, if they don't execute the white madman, they're the It's actually very hard to assimilate.
Yeah. It's the exact polar reverse opposite of that Joel Schumacher movie with Matthew McConaughey as the lawyer. Yeah, A Time to Kill. It's the exact opposite, where they're trying to get Samuel Jackson off because he killed a racist white guy who raped his daughter.
Yeah, and the exact polar opposite.
Yeah, and this is like they're trying to get a white guy off because he killed a black cop for, you know, but it's the intentions in this one are... You know, you can't argue with the results. They did stop an execution, but, you know, I mean, the guy did do it. So it's like, it's very...
Yeah, but he did it because he was stressed out from losing his job.
He was stressed out. I forgot how stressed he was. I'm sorry. He was so stressed.
The scene where Hildy interviews him, like I said, in his Hannibal Lecter birdcage is so funny to me because, like, John, you mentioned earlier just how, like, how pathetic he is. Like, you know, it's like, you know, like if Jodie Foster went into the, you know, interview Hannibal Lecter and he sounded like droopy dog and was, you know, oh, Clarice, I could see a window.
It's so funny because he's like, he really kind of, because he's so pathetic and scrawny and like weird and inarticulate, if you really like listen to what he's saying about like why he did it, he is like a total psycho. He's like, I was just so tired and I don't know what happened. It's like, oh my god, like I can't believe I've seen this. This is like the third time I've seen this movie maybe, and it's like the first time it's really jumped out at me how dark and like kind of depraved it is at times.
He asks to be killed. I mean, like, yeah. Earl Williams, when he has a gun pointed at him, he just goes, oh, just shoot me. And he, like, you know, it's like this poor Patsy in the middle of all of this.
Yeah.
I got an element to this movie that I want to discuss, and like, this will carry through to Bring You Up, Baby.
Yeah.
It's just how good a comic actor Cary Grant is.
Yeah.
Like, it's astonishing. Like, there are so many lines he delivers in this movie that are just so funny. And there's one where he's talking to the fiance. You remember this? And he's talking about Hildy. And he goes, she's old, Bruce. Can't you see her, Bruce? Look how old she looks. And then Bruce, the fiance, is an insurance salesman. And him and Hildy are going to move to Albany. And they're like, oh, Albany, it's pretty great. They have the state capitol up there. And Cary Grant's like, oh, I never heard of it. And he says, yeah, Albany's a great town for insurance. A lot of people take it out early. And then Cary Grant says, I could see why.
He is so fucking hot.
It has
to be said.
He's so hot.
He's the most hot.
Yeah.
It's really wild.
And you know what? I think all of us might have had a shot with him back in the day.
When I saw Bring Up Baby for the first time, I was like, I had this like week long feeling of just childlike. Just it felt so unfair to me that I could never kiss him.
Yeah,
and it still does today.
I mean, even especially in Bring Up Baby, his like the physical comedy he does is
King of the Pratfall.
Yes.
Like, how can you be that good looking and that good at falling on your fucking face and having
hilarious? He was like a vaudeville acrobat originally.
Yeah. He's a circus performer.
He was a circus performer. He was a Coney Island carnival barker. He spent a lot of his youth in Coney Island and also worked as an escort to support himself in his vaudeville days.
So amazing.
Wow.
He's like, so cool. And also, I think he's one of the only old Hollywood actors or actresses to a mid-Atlantic accent from the other side, you know, because usually it's like
from England. Yeah.
If you're born, usually it's actors born in America and they're like,
mimicking,
you know, they go
Brits
halfway over and they go talk like this. But he was like full British and then just like, you know, changed his accent to be, you know, halfway across the pond.
It's a big thread throughout movie mindset is like when we discuss some of these older films, it's just like the lives of like Hollywood stars in the past are just seem so much richer than they are today.
Yeah,
it's like, Cary Grant, just like last episode, we talked about Robert Mitchum, who became an actor when like the metal lathe he was working on spit some piece of steel into his eyes and was just like, well, yeah. guess I better stop being a hobo and just try going in front of a camera. Whereas, like, you know, Cary Grant was just sort of like, you know, like a carnival barking, circus performing prostitute, essentially. Yeah. And then became, he was just like, hey, but you see him, put him in front of a camera, and he just start him talking. And goddamn, like, you just see, like, and John, you mentioned, like, when we get to Bring Up Baby, what I love about that movie is that, like, Cary Grant basically plays himself in every movie with minor variations.
Yeah.
Yes.
And in Bringing Up Baby, he plays a nerd. And you know he's a nerd because he wears glasses.
Distinct.
Yeah.
But I do think his performance is very distinct in Bringing Up Baby comparatively.
Yes.
You know, it's obviously, it's like the same speed and rhythms, mm-hmm. but it's still, I think it's psychologically very different.
Yes, he's like Dante going through hell in Bringing Up Baby. It really is. Yeah. It's more stressful than Uncut Gems to watch, I think. Yes, he's an autistic kid.
He's autistic.
I do think that actually, when we talk about Bringing Up Baby, we can talk about the nightmare of it and the autism of it. Because it does feel like Hepburn is the bewilderment of the social emotional life. Like, you know what I mean? Pressing in on a person who just actually can't keep up with it.
Yeah.
Like,
who just wants to build a dinosaur.
It's like, well, you know what? We brought it up. Why don't we just go into Bring Up Baby? We can come back.
Well, can I say one thing? Yeah. Okay. I just want to talk about Rosalind Russell, which I was really struck in the kind of the first scene. She goes, I guess, into the newsroom with the men.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's such.
Hello, boy.
Yeah, there's such respect. Like, it's so dignified. It's just such an interesting. It's an archetype that has, like, become so crass. Like, the kind of one of the guys, girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because in this, I was very sad. I was like, we've lost so much watching that scene. Because, like,
she's one of the guys,
but it's like they revere her. It's not like, oh, she burps like us, you know. She watches football like us. It's like, no, she's exalted on high. Like,
it's not like she has a cigar with us after work. It's like she's like the best reporter we have.
Exactly. It was so sexy. It was so cool.
I'm so sick of all these fake journalism girls that try to, like, pretend to be interested in getting the scoop or getting a man off death row. But, you know,
the Rosalind Russell, like, journalism gate instead of gamer gate. It's
and no one in this movie cares about ethics and journalism, by the way.
Absolutely.
She feeds the line to, it's very interesting. Like, she feeds the line to Earl Williams about production for use.
Yeah.
When they're sitting there, she's like, and don't you think that put that in your mind? And he goes, yeah, it did. And you don't know if her angle in the story is, look how easily this person can be fed lines, or if she's just going to use that as if it was his statement.
Yeah. I mean, her character in this is honestly, like, one of the most imitated characters in... People do it all the time, especially, like, in comedies. You see it in a few Coen Brothers movies. There's a character like this, most notably the Hudsucker Proxy.
Jennifer Jason Leigh, the Hudsucker Proxy.
Jennifer Jason Leigh does maybe, like, the best impression of Rosalind Russell in this movie, like, of all time, where she's like, you know, I read it. It got me all wet, man. Groovy. Hanging up the phone. But, in that movie, there is that, like, one of the boys angle, but there's, like, a meta commentary on it, and it's like, oh, she actually really just wants to, settle down and be, like, a housewife, which I didn't really like that in that movie. I'm like, why do they, you know, I kind of like that she, you know, the movie ends with her telling her ex-fiance right before he leaves, like, I gotta stay here. I'm not a housewife. I'm a newspaper man.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, right. Period. Period. You know?
She's extremely, I think she's extremely, like, attractive in this movie. Like, and I'm always very, very struck by her beauty. Like, the beauty in her face and the beauty of her, like, her somehow, poise. I don't know, she feels trapped between two worlds, you know, like, because she's not yielding fully to, like, one of the guy's energy. It's not like she's hunched over and shoveling, like, lo mein into her mouth. She's she's maintaining her poise and But it's, she feels torn, you know, so that's why I feel like she's the only one who really cries in the movie, and it's very, she's the only one who could cry, and it's very beautiful when she cries. Her eyes are very emotional.
Her, when she's at gunpoint too, her like dramatic acting, sorry to, you know, categorize this thing so crassly, but like I just, she's just so good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She's so, no, absolutely.
Good. John, that was a good point, but I'm giving you one demerit for categorizing it so crass.
I'm really sorry. That was fucked up.
You've been disciplined. You've been rumbled, sir.
For every demerit, we're bringing your voice up one octave in the edit.
But throughout the episode, right?
Yeah, exactly. You should hear that Theta got a few last episode that she was on, so her voice is going to be... But for trans women, we bring it down an octave.
We bring it down. Yeah. We don't want to reward them.
But they're like... Theta, like you talk about, like the ending of this movie, and what I like so much about it is it, like, you know, it did actually remind me a lot of your film Stress Positions, in that His Girl Friday has this very elliptical construction, in which that very much eschews this kind of like three act plot in which like the characters learn something or change.
Yeah,
and this movie is a very like conscious, like the opposite of that, in which like things happen, but the whole movie is about people thinking that, like, Hedy Johnson, yeah, she thinks she's going to change. Cary Grant's character thinks he's going to change. But really, the whole point of the movie is that nobody changes.
Yes.
And, like, the ending right is that, like, the around, ending begins, yeah, in an office. And, like, they're, like, are they restarting their marriage or not? Yes and no. It doesn't really matter. They're just back exactly where they started at the end of this movie.
Yes.
But there is a reward, you know, it is, mm-hmm, seductive to like to surrender to that, to stop trying. And like, I don't, yeah, know, it's so sexy to give into Cary Grant.
It is. But I did feel watching it this time, I felt like dark about it. I felt like,
yeah,
because it's sort of the weird feeling is when she goes, can we go to Niagara Falls? And he goes, yes. And then within 5 seconds, they've changed the plan. They're going to go cover, yeah, a strike in Albany.
Yeah.
And he walks out of the room first, and she goes after him carrying her suitcase. Mm-hmm. And she's hurrying after him, and then it's over. And like, you do go, whoa, that happened really, really quick. It's almost, yeah, like an eclipse or something. Like, as soon as you see it happening, it gets undercut, you know, and I go, oh my God, I felt so sad, because it is the death of, it's like, if you want to be like a punk and a queer about it, or if you want to, it's like the death of the dream of domestic normal life.
Yeah.
And like, maybe that's rebellious and cool. Like, you know, mm-hmm, fuck it. Like, fuck being a wife, and have raising children, whatever. But like the death of that dream, the fact that it was like not just it failed, but that it was always doomed to fail, that she could never have gone to Albany with Ralph Bellamy and like lived with that mother-in-law and like raised, just would never have worked.
Yeah.
It's like cathartic and liberating and also like very depressed. It's the death of that dream. I don't know. I feel like it's very sad about, but like what you say, how could you resist Cary Grant? Like, how, yes, could you, yeah, resist Cary Grant in that mode? That, like, that as a Mephistophelian sex god. Like,
yeah.
There's a few gags I want to talk about in this movie. Yeah. A few of the minor characters. First of all, I mentioned it earlier, but another classic comedy gag that we need to bring back is violence to mothers-in-law. Mothers-in-laws.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because like the mother-in-law shows up for one scene in this movie, and then Cary Grant has her literally abducted by his hood friend, who picks her up and puts her on his shoulder and throws her into a car that gets into a car accident that nearly kills her.
Yeah.
But there's a moment where the mother-in-law is, of course, extremely indignant and like hates Cary Grant. And there's just a scene where he goes, excuse me, madam, are you referring to me? And
this is one of the, that's one of the greatest.
It's one of the best lines. It's one of the funniest fucking. It's just, and it's not especially about the joke. It's the way he says it is so fucking funny.
Did this man have anything to do with it? Well, he was in charge of the whole thing. He told told them to kidnap me.
Excuse me, madam, are you referring to me?
Well, you know you did.
And his gesture, he does the big hand.
He puts his hand to his chest. Yeah, yeah, he puts his hand to his chest, and he like goes up like an ostrich, and goes, are you referring to me?
Like, he's
and
almost like...
And it stands out as something completely insane, almost like when Al Pacino goes, but great ass.
Yeah, like, great ass! Are you referring to me, madam?
Yeah.
It's so extreme.
There's another such moment in Bringing Up Baby that we'll get to.
Oh,
but,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's the exact equivalent. Yeah.
The famous leap. Yes.
Yeah. Well, no. I want to say that because that is moment of Bringing Up Baby. But, yeah. Actually, that is historical for a lot of reasons. But yeah. The other main gag I want to talk about is that, like, a gag that's carried out for, like, the last 20 minutes of this movie of keeping a convicted murderer in a roll-top desk.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bring back the roll top desk. Bring back the gag.
Yes.
We can't. Absolutely. We can't hide convicted criminals in our open concept.
Yeah, His Girl Friday never would have worked in a WeWork.
No,
yeah. Yeah. Get that shit out of here. Desks should be big enough to hide a convicted murderer in.
Yeah,
and like essentially the setup for this is that Earl Williams is like on the eve of his execution, interviewed by a police psychologist to determine, which is like, it's funny, they're trying to determine whether he's sane enough like 12 hours before they're gonna break his neck.
Check on this.
There's a great, like, with the sheriff in this movie, like the New York City sheriff is such fucking moron. Like, he there's a scene where he walks in with a police psychologist and like they're talking about and Earl Williams, the convicted man, is just sitting there looking like, you know, forlorn, and the sheriff goes in, they're like, he's like, yeah, we're gonna run through this, we've moved up the execution schedule by 2 hours, and then he looks at Earl Williams and he goes, oh hey. Oh, hello. But then, like, as part of the clinical analysis of this guy, the police psychologist is like, I want you to reenact the crime that you just did. And the sheriff is like, oh, you can use my gun.
Yeah.
And they play act him shooting, but with a real gun. And then he uses it to escape.
To escape.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
that's an incredible touch.
I just realized who the killer Earl Williams reminds me so much of is Hans Moleman from The Simpsons.
Yes. Yes.
Just a pathetic small man who is like very put upon and very, you know, quiet. People don't notice him. And it's kind of like, you know, just shoot me. I'm 35 years old.
I even found him sexually attractive. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
He's like a doe.
It's
like,
John,
he's
just
like
his proximity
doe
to Cary Grant.
Yeah.
You can fix him.
I also want to say, I would like to play, if I had to choose a role in this movie, maybe we should all choose one. I would play the guy whose desk it was.
Yeah. Oh, it's like his Benzinger. The bad poet who they hire to keep him from going to his desk. That scene is so incredible. It's like such a little bit of surplus comedy that guy walks in. They hire him. He recites his poem. He like reaches to pat Cary Grant on the back and then like pulls his hand back.
He upper hands Cary Grant because he's so hot.
Yeah. And him being like, let me get my rhyming dictionary.
It doesn't need to rhyme. It doesn't need to rhyme.
A funny gag would have been when they finally do open the desk if Earl Williams was reading the rhyming dictionary. Cool. But I think I would want to play Rosalind Russell, or maybe do a gender swapped Pettibone. I love Petty. He was the funniest character in this movie.
I have him in my notes as the reprieve oaf.
Yes. He has the reprieve and he's like, it's so funny because the mayor and the sheriff are such hapless morons, and they're like, their idea to get him to like not give the reprieve is like, you know, it's like in Mission Impossible when they send the guy whose desk they steal the knock list from, like, I want him operating a radio tower in Alaska by 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. It's like, why don't you become like, I forget what they even do. They're like, why don't you make stamps forever? And we'll give you like a 1%, another, an extra dollar a week. And he's like, well, I don't know if I want to do that, but I suppose I could do that if that would be okay with you.
You know what's interesting about him, too, is that he is the model in the movie of the happily married.
Yes.
Like, it's actually
he's the only wife guy in the movie.
Yeah.
And no, it truly, I think I did a bad job earlier of explaining the gag with, but like, anytime anyone brings up his wife, he immediately becomes defensive about her appearance without anyone saying anything about it.
Yeah, totally.
It's such a good gag. Being like, I'll have you know, my wife is beautiful to me. And I don't care what anyone says. Oh, it's so good. Like, it really is like Cary Grant is a shark in a sea of oafs, and he's like trying to get Rosalind Russell like you're a shark too, like let's swim around and be killers together, you know, like
it's really hard to imagine that being as good with a man. It's like the original front page with like two men who just want to report on stories together.
Like, maybe if it was homoerotic,
you see it like now with two men who want to report on stories, but like All the President's Men, and like, which is an amazing movie, but it's also like the way it views journalism is so different. Like, I think Watergate really changed, and that movie also,
journalists like themselves and their profession way too fucking much.
Movies
like this, to bring it back to reality. I remember Alexander Coburn talking about the difference between the British and the American press. Is he said there's not a single journalist in Britain who likes themselves or is sober past 3 p.m.
Yeah.
And this is that old school thing. And again, like, I just love Theta and John, to come back to your movie for a little bit, like movies that take place largely in one setting.
Yeah.
And I love like just how much action and like just like how much sort of momentum that you can get just being in one room. And like the last 20 minutes of this movie, just so much happens in that press room. Like,
yeah.
The mayor and their cronies, like during a prison escape, all injure themselves in like tear gas and friendly fire accidents.
Yeah.
And the last 20 minutes of the movie is Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant just picking up 10 different phones and shouting things into them. Like, it's like, no, boom, take Hitler off the front page, put him on the funny pages. Keep the Rooster story, that's human interest. No, we married the sheriff's daughter. Yes, the homely girl.
And, no, my another like genius little bit of like scripting and construction in the movie is, as all of the reporters are out once Williams escapes, all of them except like Rosalind Russell and eventually Cary Grant when he gets there, they all run out of the press room and they're like getting, getting the scoops. And as Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant are in the press room working on like the big scoop, because they have the actual killer like hidden in a desk, and they're trying to arrange it so that they can turn him in, but only like once they have a story. And like, they, as they're working on this big scoop, all of these other reporters, like one at a time, keep running in, picking up a phone and giving like some kind of bullshit, like nothing story about like that's like on the periphery of the big story. And they have no idea that like, as they're doing a report on like, oh, as they were looking for Earl Williams, a woman gave birth in the back of a police car because she was having labor. She went into labor on the sidewalk. And like, they're like running in telling stories like that. And, you know, the mayor's men like injuring themselves by setting off a tear gas grenade when it's on their belt. like in the Thin Red Line. Like
classic cop behavior.
Yeah.
Just imagine if fentanyl was around back then.
Oh man, that would have been.
And just like, all the people yelling into phones, like the last, like the climax of this movie, like throughout the entire movie, it reminds me like almost of Robert Altman in the overlapping dialogue.
Yeah.
But recorded without multi-track recording, which is just, I can't even, like the sound mixing on this movie are like, I can't even imagine how complicated that was.
The thing that is so, that the fact that I'm amazed by is like, I saw this in a Bogdanovich, one of his weird little PBS intros, but like that he would do to classic movies. They scripted the lines in like they engineered them so that the overlapped portions were negligible. So that so that that somebody would keep talking, but you would never worry about what they were saying because it would be like, you know what I mean, or something.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Meanwhile, the next line would start. And so it's all like pre-mixed as writing.
I mean, Bringing Up Baby does, I feel like, something similar where, but also like not exactly the same, but something similar where if there's a big laugh line, the stuff that's said immediately after is never like as important as the stuff like that comes after a few seconds, because they're like, oh, the audience is going to be too busy laughing and they won't be able to hear this line. But
we can't stop. Speech will continue, but it will make a negligible speech. I think it's so incredible.
Yeah. And the going back to the Altman thing, like I feel like the most Altman early kind of the most Altman pre-Altman movie maybe that I can think of is The Thing from Another World, which also is Howard Hawks, right? And the dialogue in that movie is so like, it's so ahead of its time. It's like decades and decades ahead of its time. It's crazy.
I haven't seen that.
It's great. It's about a giant carrot that comes to life and kills people.
Theta, have you seen the John Carpenter? Have you seen the John Carpenter is the thing?
No, I have to.
Get off this call right now and watch The Thing from Another World.
I'll watch it tonight.
And then the remake, John Carpenter is the thing. It's like two of the best movies ever made.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I think without further ado, we need to talk about Baby.
I know, but I do. I'm sorry to bring us right back. I just want to say that I'm working on a contemporary update of His Girl Friday, but it's set at Hello Giggles.
What is Hello Giggles? Sorry, you have to explain it to me, John.
I honestly don't even know. Hello Giggles is like when we first got on Twitter, and it was like, I don't know, it was like really soft, kind of girly news.
Yeah, I remember that.
Remember?
Yeah. Holy fuck.
I do remember.
You lied to me.
Yes, but just a little bit. I mean, no.
Story about
but it
a leopard.
Isn't a ridiculous story. I have.
Where is the leopard?
In there.
I don't believe you.
But you must believe me.
I've been
me,
the victim once more of your unbridled imagination.
So we need to talk. We need to talk about Baby.
And, yeah.
Gang, I love both of these movies, but I feel like Bringing Up Baby, I feel like I watch this movie almost every year, and each time it gets funnier to me. Like, Bringing Up Baby is truly one of my favorite comedies of all time. Yeah. And as I'm rewatching it most recently, you already mentioned this, but the movie it really most reminds me of is Uncut Gems, because it feels like having, having a 2-hour panic attack, but like in place of the Ethiopian black opal. It's the intercostal clavicle of a brontosaurus.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, like, okay, Bringing Up Baby opens with the wonderful Museum of Natural History, one of my favorite museums. But it's just right off the bat, for some reason, I think one of the funniest moments in this movie is the very first line of the movie, where it's like, so some people working at the museum, and they refer to Cary Grant's character, Dr. Huxley, and they go, oh, that's Dr. Huxley. Don't bother him right now. He's thinking. And it just gets to him, and he's sitting like 30 feet up on a scaffolding looking at a dinosaur skeleton just with his hand curled on his chin. And they're like, don't bother Dr. Huxley. He's thinking about dinosaurs.
Yeah. When it's so good, because you know the second that like you see that giant skeleton.
The dinosaur.
That shit is going.
Chekhov's brontosaurus.
Yes. And he's like, I've spent the last 6 years of my life dedicated day in, day out, every day to building this dinosaur.
Yeah.
John, I mentioned it before, but like, what I love, like, Cary Grant is playing a nerd in this movie. And you know he's a nerd because he wears glasses. And what I love about this is that, like, it's like the male version of She's All That, where like a really hot woman like takes her glasses off and everyone's just like, what? Oh my God, she's stunning.
Yeah.
Like, but Katharine Hepburn throughout this movie keeps telling him, you know, you look so much more handsome without your glasses on. It's just like, what the fuck? He's Cary Grant. He could be wearing a fucking clown makeup. Like, he could have like snot coming out of his nose. It wouldn't matter.
Have you guys seen Monkey Business?
Monkey Business? I don't think I've seen Monkey Business.
It's so good.
Monkey Business is like Bring Up Baby in the sense that Cary Grant plays another scientist, another nerd, but a weathered one. He's playing somebody who's like older than he was at the time, because the premise is that they discover a youth potion.
Oh,
there's an analogous thing where he takes the potion and just becomes Cary Grant. Mm-hmm. And it's like the equivalent of when he takes off his glasses and he becomes Cary Grant, or when he gets wet, like in this in Bringing Up Baby, when he gets wet, like when he takes a shower, or when he falls into the river, he becomes Cary Grant. And it's like, it's interesting. It is a She's All That thing, like right under the
It's like
surface.
Gremlins. Yeah. Never get Cary Grant wet or he'll turn into Cary Grant. Cary Grant is Dr. David Huxley, and he is, of course, engaged to Dr. Alice Swallow. Dr. Alice Swallow is like a James Bond girl. And then later in the movie, he's given the alias Dr. David Bone by Katharine Hepburn. So is Dr.
Crazy?
David Bone engaged to Alice Swallows?
Yeah. I don't even know what to make of that.
Oh, I was just going to say, I love the, this is in both movies, obviously. Like, I love the dud spouse.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, that's another classic gag.
We're rooting for someone not because they're doing something, like, or we're not rooting for someone not because they've done something bad. They're just kind of dull. And they're no fun.
And she's particularly dour.
Yeah.
She's really particularly the only interaction we see between Dr. David Huxley and Dr. Alice Swallows is that she says, Our marriage must entail no domestic entanglements of any kind. Yeah. We don't have time for a honeymoon. And he's like,
no honeymoon, no child, no sex. Because look, when she doesn't say let's use contraception, or what she means is we won't be fucking. Your job.
We will never be
this dinosaur. Yeah. We will never be fucking.
But every married person needs a honeymoon. And she's like, not us. we need a dinosaur.
Yeah. I do think it's incredible. I do think another crazy thing about this movie that would never happen in a movie. Bring a Baby is really bizarre and really, like, really hellish, like really nightmarish. But one of the most amazing nightmare logic things about it is the way that he is supposed to get married at 3 o'clock the next afternoon. There's no oh my God, I am supposed to be married. Let's hail a cab and drive back to the city. It's not a plot point. It's
noon. I'm getting married at 3. Yeah, I have time to drive to Connecticut with this insane woman.
I have no choice. I have no choice.
He is held hostage in this movie. Yeah. He is victimized nonstop. And we really talk about the star of this movie. The movie really begins with his world changes when he has a random encounter on a golf course with Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah.
Who plays his ball on the golf course, and as soon as he engages with her, and just being like in his flustered way, I'd be like, "Madam, that's my ball. I'm trying to play. It's got a red dot on it," and she keeps playing it, and from there she never lets up. I mean, I'm just gonna put it up here: Katharine Hepburn in this movie is the most frightening, menacing, and dangerous character ever depicted in a film.
She's Bugs Bunny. She's just Bugs Bunny. She is literally just Bugs Bunny torturing, like, Porky Pig.
Yes. But you're not... you can't identify with her in the movie. It's not... she's not, like... you see her from his view.
Yeah.
This frightening figure.
that he is nonetheless drawn to. I mean, he says at one point, one of the great lines is, I mean, in moments of quiet, I'm quite drawn to you. But, I mean, there haven't been any moments of quiet yet.
I wrote down that. That's one of my favorite lines. Yeah. Like, within 10 minutes of encountering this woman, she has stolen his golf ball, stolen his car, and then later makes him slip on an olive and crush his top hat.
Framed him for stealing a purse.
This is where I think is very... I was like thinking about this a little bit. I was like, is it in its own weird way love at first sight? It's like definitely disaster at first sight.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
But I think that the love literally begins when they walk cock to ass across the restaurant.
From
truly. That point on, the fate is sealed. That is actually the quiet moment. It's like...
yes.
This very sexually backed up guy,
cocked
ass.
They both rip, Cary Grant's he's wearing a tux and tails, and it gets ripped up his back. And of course, he is in permanent befuddlement mode every time he's with her.
Yeah.
But then her dress gets ripped, so her ass is hanging out. Yeah. And then like they both have to cover for each other walking around this big grand ballroom, dick to ass. And
dick.
Dick to ass. Yeah.
Dick to ass. It's over for him from that point on.
And you know like, what? Yeah.
He loves her.
I found that a very sexy scene.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Very sexy.
Very sexy movie.
And I mean, going back to what John said about how he's autistic, it really does like tracking it through that lens. It's like he, you know, and Katharine Hepburn kind of representing, you know, social life and exciting love, and like, which obviously when he first encounters it, it's the scariest thing in the world, and it keeps fucking up like stuff that's going on. But like that moment he realizes like, oh, this is kind of fun though. You know,
yeah.
Like it's fun to be like in getting into antics and doing wacky shit. You know, he says at the end in the last scene, like, that was the best day of my entire life.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
I know. I cried at the end. I got like choked
up. This movie always makes me cry. It really kills me. And,
yeah.
And Katharine Hepburn really, really makes me cry. It's
yeah.
such a special performance.
Mm-hmm. No, it's truly like she's full Bugs Bunny. And, you know, you do feel for her by the end, I think. You feel for both of them. And you're like,
I
so
feel
happy.
For her from the beginning. I know that she is an agent of chaos and terror on paper, on a plot level, but she doesn't terrify me. I think she's so, she's just twinkling the whole movie. And I never knew her, like, I never really knew her work before I saw this movie. And I obviously knew, like, the impression of Katharine Hepburn, the very, like, filtered and mid-Atlantic thing.
Yeah.
And very kind of, like, hard.
Yeah.
Hard. Masculine.
Which she does an impression of she does an impression of herself in this movie.
Yeah.
Where she
and the jail scene.
Yeah.
You want someone to talk, don't you?
Well, it's about time. I certainly do.
Yeah, well, get me out of this cooler and I'll unbutton my puss and shoot the works.
You'll up? Say, hold on, lady. I thought that you were... But, hey, you ain't no lady.
Yeah, I kind of had your fool for a minute, didn't I?
You sure did.
Make a sucker out of a copper. What did I tell you my name was?
Why, your name is... Dot, what's your name?
Susan Vance.
Susan Vance.
Bob, giddy Bob, Christmas Society Monica. But the marble calls me Swingin' Door Susie.
Swingin' Door Susie.
Now do you peg me? Come on, toots, open up. Open up.
Stop that.
Yeah.
Yes. But it's so light. Her she's so light touch in this movie in a way that I didn't know she was capable of based on what people say about her. You know. I don't know, so watery, I think.
Yes. It's very it would definitely be wrong to call her character a manic pixie dream girl. Because I think this is way before that. I think the concept of a manic pixie dream girl is some, as it like happens later in the history of cinema. I think maybe the first one ever is like Something Wild that I can think of, but like the this like wild woman is that in this movie the world bends to her whim. Like, she is so effervescent.
There is no source of authority that can rein her in. She stitches up every single person who tries to, like, get her to do something.
She somehow captures a killer leopard. Like, she
that's the most
wrestles
thing.
With nature and wins.
Like, she shows up with it. She shows up with it already with the... She's leashed him. But,
one of the
know,
funniest
like,
gags in the movie.
Okay, The leopard, gag at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
I would say no. Katharine Hepburn in this movie is she's not a manic pixie dream girl. She's a BPD baddie. She's a BPD baddie, and that is what all autistic men secretly want and need is a BPD baddie. But we're talking about like things that could kill you, as if like the befuddlement and tension of this movie in like the first half an hour wasn't bad enough. The movie really gets going with the introduction of Baby, played by Nisa the leopard. And that's a real leopard. And I just want to talk about probably one of my favorite shots, one of my favorite visual gags in any movie ever is like after they've walked around dick to ass, the next day she calls him and she said, like, you know, Cary Grant thought he had escaped her.
Yeah.
She calls him the next day, the day of his wedding, and says, "Do you want a leopard? You're the only zoologist I know." And it's Katharine Hepburn, and she's sitting at like her nice like makeup mirror table. She's like wearing this like nightgown. She's looking great, and she says, "Yeah, my brother brought back a leopard from Brazil." And he goes, a stuffed leopard, thinking like it's a stuffed leopard. And when he says that line over the phone, then you see the introduction of Baby. A real fucking leopard steps out of Katharine Hepburn's and just prances out of Katharine Hepburn's bathroom, walks right up to her, and nuzzles her leg exactly like a cat. Like, okay,
and
first of all,
he says,
Cary Grant was so terrified of the leopard in this movie that all of the scenes with Cary Grant and the leopard are just trick photography. Like,
yeah,
you see
no,
his
I
leg
that.
Getting like, yeah, like it's all like it's either rear projection or it's like a stunt double's leg. Because Cary Grant was so terrified of this fucking full-grown African leopard. But the scene with Katharine Hepburn, there is no like camera trickery that can duplicate that. And what they did is apparently, Katharine found this out for me last night, Nisa the leopard was trained with fragrances. And they essentially they perfumed Katharine Hepburn's legs to get her to like walk up and nuzzle it.
Wow.
Like, I don't need any perfume to smell Katharine Hepburn's legs. Woo! But like I said, the introduction of the leopard just ratchets up the tension in this movie 1,000-fold because now there is, you know, a man-sized cat stalking every frame of this movie.
Yes. And it is insane that the cat is called Baby. Like, when the childless, it's like when you introduce the idea of childlessness right up top, like within the first 60 seconds of the movie, then you have the... You have the life force represented by BPG Batty, Susan Vance, Katharine Hepburn, and then you have the life force of a child, of offspring, represented by this wild animal. I don't know what to make of it, but it's extremely overdetermined.
Calling it Baby and having this huge, like, sort of like almost a literal white elephant in the room all the time is like in the 19, like, you know, in the, this movie was made in 1938. It's like, the implication of children is always a stand-in for sex and, like, you know, like sexual explicit the implication of sex that can't directly be referenced. So, like, in this case, the leopard stalking around the room, like, menacing every second of this movie is just the threat of them eventually having sex.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Which,
the scariest thing in the world.
I just got to talk about one of my absolute favorite lines in this movie. Is when she gets him to come over by pretending that the leopard is attacking her. she cons him into like rescuing her because she's pretending like she's undergoing an animal attack in her apartment. And then Cary Grant walks into her bathroom, sees the leopard, and then does the classic slam the door, like,
it's great.
And he goes, Susan, you've got to get out of this apartment. And she says, but I can't. I have a lease.
This is part of her power is that she doesn't it's almost like she refuses to understand any question or anything the way that it's intended.
She's one
the Joker.
Of my favorites.
She's
right
the
before
freaking
that,
Joker.
when they're on the phone and Cary Grant is like, so it's a stuffed leopard. And because she says like, oh, my brother was in the jungle hunting leopards and he brought one back. And he's like, oh, so it's a stuffed leopard. And she says, as the leopard's like walking into frame for the first time, she says like, why would he be hunting stuffed leopards?
exactly.
Such a great line.
That's where all of her power comes from. It's so amazing. She says the same thing where he's like, there's a rat there. The mark on his golf ball is a circle. And she goes, well, it could hardly roll if it wasn't a circle. What? I don't even remember the line.
She says also when he keeps trying to tell her that it's his ball, he's like, no, that's a top flight. That one's mine because it has the dot on it. Yours has the line. And she's like, well, I'm not picky. I'm not particular.
Exactly. It's a nightmare. It's quicksand. It's quicksand.
Apparently this movie went 40 days over shooting schedule because of the leopard, but also Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn's constant ad-libbing on this movie. Just they kept cracking up in every scene.
So they
went 40 days over schedule because of just how much fun they were having. You know,
you feel it. You feel it.
Yes, it's contagious.
Crazy.
Yeah,
it's so infectious. There's nothing
and
like it.
I just like Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn, as great as they are, I really just want to highlight the performance of Nisa the leopard in this movie. And I have this in my notes for you. Me watching the movie this time around, I was like Abel Ferrara on the King of New York commentary talking about Buscemi. Yeah. But I go, look at the leopard. Look at the leopard. There's Nissa. Look at it. Look at that. Look at that leopard. We love it.
No, I was wondering if the leopard, if Nissa also play. I mean, I can't imagine they got another leopard to play the evil.
I think Nissa plays both parts. I would
interesting.
Oh, yeah.
It was
exciting.
It made me kind of sad to see Nissa as like an evil leopard, because I was like, oh, they had to get her to be evil for a second. It was like, oh, it shattered the illusion of like this beautiful, tame, harmless leopard that's somehow in the movie.
So Katharine Hepburn, she drives Cary Grant to like her aunt's house in Connecticut with a leopard.
Another wealthy dowager.
And another
it turns out
in this movie, Aunt Random. The name of her aunt is Aunt Random. And then it's revealed that Aunt Random is the woman with $1 million that was he was going to give it to the Dino Fund of the Museum of Natural History. But like, he's fucked things up so bad, he can't let her know who he is, that he's Dr. Huxley. But I want to talk about like one of the many clothes disasters in this movie is that Cary Grant is like covered in feathers, basically, because baby gets out and like, you know, ravages like a chicken coop, essentially. So when he gets to their house, gets to Aunt Random's house in Connecticut, he's like, I need to take a shower. And while he's in the shower, Katharine Hepburn, Susan Vance, takes all of his clothes, gives it to the maid, and has her send them into town to be pressed. So just like, intervening once again to prevent him from getting married. So the only clothes he has to wear, so he comes out of the shower and he is wearing this like puffy woman's negligee.
Yeah.
Which I want to point this out.
Which leads to, I mean, I'll set it for you, like, it leads to one of the most famous, historical, and most hilarious lines in this movie.
I won't even talk about that line. I just want to say that this time watching, I was so amazed at the sight gag of the way the reveal of that negligee robe sort of works, which is that you see him, his face is at the door, he understands that he has no clothes, and then he goes back and you see his shadow putting on a robe, and you do expect him to walk out in a normal bathrobe. Like, because it's all his shadow, you get to totally imagine him putting on one type of robe. And then when he comes out in that outfit, it's so explosive. And it's just an amazing bit of visual logic. I was really admiring that. But Will, you should talk about the line when he answers the door.
So then like, he's walking around this strange woman's house. He doesn't know anyone. He's been abandoned by Katharine Hepburn and is wearing a frilly lady's negligee. And then the doorbell rings.
Which looks amazing, by the way.
He's tearing in it.
The doorbell rings and he has to answer the door. And it is Aunt Random. She is the queen of old battle axes. We get so much more of an annoying old bat in this movie than we have in His Girl Friday. The mother-in-law
dowager
in that movie is dispensed quickly in a car accident, whereas Aunt Random in this movie is a constant source of annoyance. And it's her house. He answers the door to her house, and it's a man wearing a woman's negligee. And she just keeps saying, I forget the exact setup, but she just goes, it's a back and forth that like it flusters him further and further. And you can just see like the tension building in his head as he's trying to like stumble over himself to explain why he is in this situation. And she just says, but why are you wearing these clothes? And he just finally gets fed up and says, because I went gay all of a sudden.
And he jumps in the air when he says that.
He jumps in the air,
knees to his head. And like, the camera goes up.
But who are you?
Who are you?
But who are you?
What do you want?
Well, who are you?
I don't know. I'm not quite myself today.
Well, you look perfectly idiotic in those clothes.
These aren't my clothes.
Well, where are your clothes?
I've lost my clothes.
Well, why are you wearing these clothes?
Because I just went gay all of a sudden.
The camera like really catches it. He goes up and down, but there is the windup is also so amazing because it's like you're looking. He's looking right down the barrel of the camera, and she goes, "Why? What are you doing in those clothes?" And his timing is so strange. He goes, "These aren't my clothes." She goes, "Where are your clothes?" He goes, "I haven't got my clothes."
And she's like, "Well, you look ridiculous."
And then he does that leaping thing, and it's just so amazing. It's so amazing.
It's really such a jarring, like the line is jarring. The camera movement is so jarring in a movie like that. Like you never see the camera move that fast in these old movies. And the like the gracefulness of his jump is truly breathtaking.
It's incredible coming from this nerd too. It's like, and I have to say, like, I know I already said it. He looks so good in the negligee that I can't even believe it. Like, he looks so just skinny and like lean and potent and like, and hot. I don't know how. And then he sits, goes and sits down on the stairs and just gives up.
He gives up. I love the look on his face where everyone else is bickering and you just see him getting, not even like interjecting, not even trying to explain himself anymore. You just see him powering down. Like his health and sanity bar are just depleted. But I want to speak of like his brilliant delivery of that line. Could have, I looked this, I couldn't find any definitive take on it, but like that very, very easily could have been a Cary Grant ad lib. Because I went gay all of a sudden. And according to Wikipedia, this is debated, but according to Wikipedia, this is heralded as the first reference in a non-pornographic film of the word gay as a reference to homosexuality and not just being happy. Wow. Yeah,
I think I have read that he ad-libbed it and that like, previous to this, like gay and homosexual weren't really like the public didn't know that that was like, you know, a word for being homosexual, and that he kind of like something about this movie made the connection in like the popular mind of like the, you know.
That's so interesting.
In 1938,
the funniest, maybe there are two parts where I laughed like harder, like I died laughing. And one is right after the gay thing, he's sitting on the stairs. Katharine Hepburn explains to the wealthy dowager aunt, like, he's lost his mind. He's here from Brazil. Like, he's insane.
He's a big game hunter.
And and at that point, the maid and the aunt are like kind of scared of him. And so they're standing there and he does this, my favorite, like one of the funniest moments in the entire movie, where he's like towering above the aunt and the maid. And he says, "Are there any clothes around?" And he's like just staring at them like this with his like chin all rumpled up. And they're like looking at him. They're stumbling over their words. And he's just like standing there like this, like completely. It's the funniest. Something about the way he's looking at them is like so genius and so fucking funny. It, but like, truly, I was dying. Like, and he, it goes on for like a while too, because it's just so perfect.
Well, that,
And, no, in this scene, we get the introduction of the other big animal star of this movie, which is George the dog. And there's something about like, okay, the leopard is named Baby, which is really funny. But there's something about pets with just like a guy's name.
Yeah.
And the fact that Catherine Hepburn keeps referring to George throughout this entire movie. Yeah, and it's just it's just a dog. And of course, the dog steals the dinosaur bone and buries it. But like in the scene where Cary Grant is just powering down and in utter defeat of his situation,
the dog is barking
nonstop. And I come back to Uncut Gems and like the door alarm going off and just the way that ratchets up, like I can feel my spine like just like curling, like every molecule in my body is screaming at like just how fucking stressful this is.
Do you know that dog is sort of a famous dog? Like he played
Cary
Grant's dog
from The Thin Man.
It's possible. I know he's in The Awful Truth, and that they had to like get the dog on loan from a different studio. I think his name was Astra or Asta or something. He's like a famous
that's
a trained dog.
It's one of those famous dogs in movie history.
One of the parts that makes me laugh so hard is when is he a zoologist? The other guy,
the Major Applegate, the actual big game hunter.
His literal entrance when the top part of the door opens.
Oh yeah, and he slits.
He gets invited in, and he just gets confused.
What's your name?
That kills me, and that is in both of these movies. Just like things are moving so fast that people's brains don't have time to catch up.
Yeah,
with what's going on, they just have to keep moving forward to the point that they're doing stuff so comically insane.
That's one of my favorite like exchanges in the movie is between Katharine Hepburn and him before he comes in, and when he's standing there like with the half door, and she's like on the phone. She's like, I forget what exactly she's doing, but she's like, at the sound of the tone, it will be 7:45, and then like, ringing a bell,
ringing the yes,
yeah. And meanwhile, he's standing and he's like checking his watch, and he's like, "Excuse me, it's 8:10." No, it's 8:10. My watch says 8:10, and she's just keeps saying like 7:45, and then like what she like turns to him and she's like, "Who are you?" And he's like, 8:10. I mean,
that's
so good.
I do think that the second half of this movie is really weird.
Yes.
In a magical way, but also in like a way. This movie was like very badly received, I think. Like it was
a bomb. People hated it.
It was a huge bomb. And part of that is because like it's not orderly. Like it doesn't like stroke every chakra in a row of comedy and get you off at the end. There's like this weird nightmare moonlit forest wandering thing.
It's a Midsummer Night's Dream. Like when they go into the forest, the logic to the movie breaks down even more. Like
there's
Catherine Hepburn's where they're cooking his socks.
They build a fire. It's like they're 100 miles away from any civilization.
They're in Greenwich. They're in Greenwich, Connecticut. Here's another classic comedy character I'd like to talk about. The groundskeeper Willie character who lets baby out of the barn.
Drunk Irishman.
Here's another classic comedy gag. A drunkard seeing something incredible and then rubbing his eyes and looking at the bottle.
Yes. That is a classic. We need more of that.
It's a classic.
Second classic bit in the the Midsummer Night's Dream forest magical realism is when there's like a small stream and Katharine Hepburn's just like, it's not deep. We can just walk across it. Cary Grant takes one step into it and plunges into like 7 feet of water.
That's such a good guy. Good.
The riverbed's changed.
The riverbed's changed. No, never that she was wrong about anything. Never.
The reason they're trying to cross the stream is because they need the dog to lead them to where the bone is buried. And they see on the other side of the stream that baby is playing with the dog. And in one of the, another one of my favorite lines from earlier is when Katharine Hepburn is reading the note from her brother about the leopard. And it says, and he really likes dogs. And she's like, I don't know if that means he likes hanging out with them or he likes to eat them. So they're like watching the two play on the other side of the river. And they're like, oh my God, he's going to eat the dog. Because she says at one point, it says that he really likes dogs. And Cary Grant's like, what if that means, he doesn't take a liking to George or something? And Katharine Hepburn's like, I mean, if he doesn't like George, he's going to eat him. She says it like, you know, that's life. You know?
Don't you think? I feel like there's something in the dog and the leopard dancing in the moonlight or whatever that does. It's like a metonym for him and her getting together at the end.
Absolutely.
Like, she's clearly the more potent force, and he is like
little dog jumping around her.
And he, at the end, he just sort of yields to, like, let's tussle, like, let's play around in the moonlight. It's kind of a beautiful prefiguring of that that scene.
It kind of, like, goes toward, like, soon after that, my favorite moment in the movie, a moment that I think is like very emblematic of the movie as a whole, is when the leopard is on the roof of this building.
Yes,
with, like, Hyatt.
That's my favorite fucking scene in this movie.
Yes, the best part, the funniest part. Yeah, they sing because the leopard loves this like song, and it's them holding the dog, and they're like, "Let's sing. He'll come down from the roof."
Yeah,
and it's them singing. And the dog starts singing too. The dog starts like howling. And then it cuts to the roof and the leopard starts like howling too. It's like the three of them, it's like he has become a wild animal.
Yeah.
He is like reduced to the level of pure like chaos and is just like completely insane.
And like the additional layer to that unbelievably hilarious moment in the movie is that the leopard is on the roof of a character who's been introduced earlier in the movie as a psychologist.
Yeah.
And there's Abner is trying to explain to this shrink that she's like, oh, I'm merely serenading the leopard on the roof of your house. And then he's just like, he's like, come with me. Well, no. Yes, the leopard's real. We'll get you help.
Yes.
And like the climax of the movie is when they're all locked up in the local drunk tank. And earlier in the movie, there's a plot line about how in the nearest town, the circus is in town.
Yeah.
And there's a part of the movie where like the circus, like the animal handlers have a leopard in a cage. And like at this point, baby has gone away. And you're like, oh, the circus, they've captured baby. And then Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant see this truck on the road. They distract the drivers and release this leopard. The best gag in the movie is at the very end when you realize it's another leopard. Two leopards in the state of Connecticut, and this one is being put in a cage because it has viciously mauled several of its handlers.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, yes. Katharine Hepburn comes in with it on a fucking leash. And then they're like, they sees baby in the other room waiting for her. Oh,
yeah.
The construction of that moment is so amazing because this kind of goes to what you're saying, Theta, about the this movie refusing to follow like a neat, like all the usual comedic beats. Because what happens is it's inside the police station and Katharine Hepburn has escaped by pretending to be Katharine Hepburn. And has like left to go look for the leopard, and they have baby in the station. So they're like, Cary Grant realizes once they tell him about this vicious leopard, he's like, oh my God, you know, she's going out to find the leopard right now. She's in danger. And like, usually what would happen is they would go out and try to save her and he would end up saving her from it.
Right.
But what actually happens is the next shot that you see, she's dragging the leopard on a rope to the front door of the police station.
She's effortlessly apprehended the violent killer leopard. There's no, it is amazing that there is none of that. There is no like Cary Grant rises to the challenge, rises to the occasion, finds his masculinity and becomes the man he was always meant to be. He just yields to her at the end. And it's wonderful. It's just so much better that way.
I mean, like, we should wrap it up here. But, of course, the end of the movie is Cary Grant, Dr. Alice Swallows has left him because he's revealed himself.
Be fun.
To be cool. Yeah, to be not just a nerd. He's got the intercostal clavicle. And he's just like the last piece of the puzzle that he's getting ready to put into this giant brontosaurus skeleton. And as I saw you post this right before we came on, but down the hall, you just hear, hi, I'm Susan Vance, and welcome to Jackass. This is destroying a priceless dinosaur skeleton. But she comes to you, she like comes up to his eye level by climbing a 30-foot ladder and then starts swaying like 30 feet in the air.
Because she's so excited that he says that he loves her.
And she, of course, to avoid falling off the ladder, climbs onto the spine of this brontosaurus and destroys it entirely.
Yeah.
It's the opposite ending of His Girl Friday. It's it's a non-circular ending. It's like there's a new stasis.
It's the perfect exclamation point. It's the perfect... Yeah.
He has let go of his
The brontosaurus
to find love and to live live life instead of, you know, doing his job that he loved. Katharine Hepburn now.
Yeah, they're about animals that have been dead for 60 million years. And like, no, that's not what life is about. It's about animals that are alive today and in this crazy woman's bathroom. But you know what? You gotta love her.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was His Girl Friday and Bringing Up Baby. Two incredibly funny movies that are, you know, Howard Hawks, but really both of them are a vehicle for Cary Grant and two incredible co-stars in Rosalind Russell and Katharine Hepburn. And I will just use this moment in our episode about screwball comedies to just give a little promo to Theta and John and your, you know, very much a film infused the DNA of these two movies, Stress Positions, in theaters now.
Thank you, Will. Thank you, Hessa.
thank you guys for coming on. And I just want to say, as because we were talking about pratfalls earlier, John, your two pratfalls in stress positions are truly inspired.
They're oh my God.
Incredible. We're bringing it back. We're bringing yes. back the pratfall.
We are. Thank you so much, Hessa. That's very, the world.
Theta Hamill, John Early, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. And everyone out there, go see Stress Positions. Hessa and I, this gets the movie mindset, two thumbs up, stamp yes. of approval. This is amazing. This is must see. This is must see movie.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the movies. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.